I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Back in the 1960s, traffic engineers took note of a phenomenon that in retrospect should have been obvious, I think, but it wasn't. If you make roads bigger and more of them, traffic will increase to meet the available space. I understand that this is called induced demand, and it almost seems to be an axiom of life. Maybe in physics, too, you know how a gas will fill the available space? No, that's actually not the right analogy, because gas does not proliferate to fill the available space. It expands. It thins out. Its density is less. But with induced demand, and this goes back to the roads and the highways, more cars are actually manufactured and purchased for all of us to drive. If you think about this long and hard enough, the weight of everything wrong with our technological world can descend upon your shoulders. It can be depressing. We're going to have a conversation now about our things, our stuff, our material possessions, and the overabundance of it all. Over the past several years, there have been more than enough analyses of our seeming inability to declutter. That's a verb these days, to declutter. There's been ample discussion of the pathology of what is called hoarding. Many times, these kinds of reflections take a bottom-line sort of approach, kind of pragmatic. What are the opportunity costs of our acquisitive habits, our penchant for keeping things that we have procured long and kept long beyond their utility? The sheer volume of our inventories in our closets, our shelves, our rooms, our garages, even digitally on our computers, in the cloud. But you know, a discussion about opportunity costs, the more I think about this, it usually gravitates toward an economic kind of perspective. It's also possible to ask moral questions here, not just economic ones. Is there perhaps something wrong, apart from the loss of our time and our money and our attention, is there perhaps something wrong with managing, storing, to say nothing of procuring all this stuff? The opposite of sparking joy might be smothering it, and the weight of the world may be in our things. Why do we do this to ourselves? Jennifer Howard is a former contributing editor for The Washington Post and a former senior reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. She's written for The Times Literary Supplement, the Virginia Quarterly Review, for Slate, and many other publications. 2020 saw the release of her book, Clutter, An Untidy History. She's with us now. Jennifer Howard, welcome to our show.
Hi, Marcus. It's great to be here.
I want to put you just for a moment in the awkward position of kind of treating you like my psychotherapist, because I want you to know how relieved I was in reading your book to see that a definition of hoarding kind of exonerates me, because the rooms in my home, they are functional. I can use them for their intended purpose. There's no cholesterol clogging the arteries of that building. And that's my confession. I'll just leave it right there. Have you had other people confess to you since writing this book?
Everybody has a story about clutter, either too much of it, trying to deal with somebody else's clutter, feeling guilty about the amount of stuff that they have, feeling like there's always a project they need to get around to. So yes, I've heard lots of stories, and there's an infinite variety of anecdote. It's fascinating.
You say fascinating. Are you being honest there? I mean, does it kind of, after a while, do you say, I've had enough of these?
You know, I have not yet gotten bored with the topic, in part because of this infinite variety, but also because these conversations remind me that what often feels like a very personal problem, you know, the stuff, too much stuff in your personal space, is actually a collective and social problem as well. And that if you feel you are struggling with clutter, you are far from alone. So I think there's some encouragement in that for me, and just I'm always interested to hear what people struggle with when it comes to their things.
So if this is in some measure a collective societal problem that is just about everywhere, how do you rank it? Is it like in the top 10, the top 20? Is it you know, a big one?
Yeah, I think it's a big one. I don't know where I'd rank it exactly, but I do know that it extracts a heavy toll on those who have to deal with it, which is frankly many, if not most of us eventually. There are a lot of hidden costs associated with hoarding disorder or just extreme clutter, you know. And it's important to point out that just because you have too much stuff in your house does not mean that you have a hoarding disorder, that you suffer from that. There is a spectrum of stuff and having too much stuff. Too much clutter can actually be lethal. It can kill you. As part of writing the book, I went up to Philadelphia and spent the day with a fire captain in an urban neighborhood in Philadelphia. And he and his team talked about what it's like to go into a house that has too much stuff in it. And it's incredibly dangerous for both the first responders and, of course, the people who live there. If they can't get you out of your house because there's too much stuff, they can't find you, you could die because you can't get the help that you need. And that was really sobering to hear that it's not just, not just a failure of organization, but it can actually be a real death trap.
And you point out that this risk of having death traps throughout our communities, that this actually might be the starting point for having the right kinds of conversations with people with this problem, because there are wrong conversations to be had too.
There are a lot of ways to go wrong. I mean, I'm sure many of the people listening to the show have seen some of the reality TV shows where there's a very dramatic intervention with somebody who's got, just too much stuff. It's often a lot of squalor. People come in and just do basically a forced clean out. And when I was researching the book, I talked to people who are social workers and therapists and people who are trained in how to deal with mental health issues. And one of them really pointed out to me that having someone come in and take your stuff out of your house is equivalent psychically to having all of your stuff destroyed by a tornado or lose it all in a fire or a flood. I mean, it's a sudden, dramatic trauma. And the last thing you want to do if you're trying to help somebody who is struggling is inflict more trauma. So one has to be really careful. You can't walk in and say, oh, this is awful. Look how, you can't live. It's just this squalor. It's awful. You can't live this way. But you might be able to go in and say, for example, if the fire captain will go into people's houses and say, can we just clear a 3-foot wide pathway between the main exits? So if I and my team ever need to come in and give you help, we can find you and get you out. And the city has a fire code, and we're not going to take most of your stuff. We're just going to help you, organize it a little bit so that you will be safe. And that's often a much more effective way to actually get somebody to listen and to accept help when it's offered.
Now, you frame the entire history that you tell with your own personal story, and I do want to touch on that in just a little bit. But before we get there, you've already kind of talked a little bit about the pathological nature of this and the way people go about maybe trying to intervene in the right or the wrong ways. Could you help me out now with understanding where we are today in how people – what the proper terminology is and what the definitions are? Because I understand it's only been fairly recently that this hoarding has landed in the diagnostic and statistical manual used by psychotherapists.
That's right. It for a long time, hoarding disorder was grouped under OCD and was considered a subset of OCD. And in 2013, the APA added it as a separate, distinct mental illness to its diagnostic manual, which is important because it then allows for more specific kinds of interventions and understandings. And it is, again, important to point out that I think it's about 2-6% of the American population who suffers from hoarding, truly diagnosable hoarding disorder. So a lot of us have extreme or fairly pronounced clutter problems. It does not mean that we would be classified as people suffering from hoarding disorder. But labels matter. They matter a lot. Again, you don't, what I took away with from a lot of my research is that the person is not the problem. And I think that applies to things well beyond clutter and hoarding disorder. But, to call somebody a hoarder reduces them to this struggle that they're having, rather than to say it's somebody who has hoarding disorder, like somebody has depression, somebody has, struggles with alcohol addiction. So it helps us understand that there's a person behind all this stuff, and that's so important. There are also some fascinating terminologies and labels that some of the people who do have real problems with clutter apply to themselves. They can describe themselves as collectors or finder keepers. And that can be, just sort of trying to understand how they think of themselves and their stuff is a really important part of this this set of approaches that's being developed now. I think we're in a kinder, gentler phase. At least I hope we are.
Yeah. I mean, the only pragmatic issue that I see is that sometimes it's hard to kind of reschool yourself in the way to mm-hmm. describe things. I mean, some of these sound – finder keepers, to me that sounds a little bit like a circumlocution, but I suppose I could get used to it.
Yeah. Well, it may be something that a person would apply – a label a person would apply to him or herself that maybe other people wouldn't use. But again, like to call somebody a hoarder, I was told fairly persuasively told that was hurtful because you're basically inviting them to throw up defenses. You're saying you have a problem rather than here's something I want to help you with.
And then there's also terminology that has been introduced to describe the locations, the residences, where what is the term? Content, something or other, the fire departments use this term.
Yes. I love that term. Heavy contents is what the Philadelphia Fire Department uses. So when the operators get a call, you know, a fire alarm call, and they have to dispatch a hook and ladder team or whoever, you know, to actually dispatch the firefighters to the scene, if they alert them that there's a heavy content situation, that means the firefighters are prepared to go in. I mean, you know, with these, they're wearing 90 pounds of gear. They have, they might be, you know, pulling water hoses, and so that they know that it may be a hard scene to access, and that allows them to sort of be prepared and keep themselves and hopefully the people they're trying to rescue safer.
And I got a notion from your book that in some communities, the fire departments might already have, well in advance, they may have identified certain problem spots with heavy content.
Yes, the fire station I visited actually had a list posted of properties that had something to be aware of if there were a call there, and about a third of them were actually heavy content situations. It was probably 80, a list of 80 yeah. or so houses in this one district in Philadelphia. And I don't know for sure that that's the case across the country, but I think it probably is.
Well, the fact that somebody would be prepared in this manner, that tells you right there that institutionally within the system, people are already thinking this through because they must have had experience in the past where they knew that too late.
Exactly. Well, you know, we continue to see these often fairly luridly presented stories, often in newspapers or on local news shows. You know, hoarder dies in fire in, you know, west part of town or something. The popular imagination knows that this is, you know, has identified this as a problem, but it actually is a problem. One issue is that there are not so far great nationwide statistics on this, and there is some energy in the firefighting community to get more statistics. But the fire captain whom I interviewed said that when he was talking to other peers around the country, he thinks it's about 25% of civilian deaths, fire-related deaths, have an element of clutter. So it's a serious, you know, going back to your earlier question of how big a problem it is, it's serious. 25% is a lot.
Yeah. Well, I want to now talk a little bit about your own story, because you frame your history with what happened to you when you inherited the task of the disposition of the personal effects and belongings of your mother. And the thing that strikes me the most about your story is not that people might live in clutter or in squalor, but that this kind of – it almost caught you unawares. How surprised were you to discover the extent of your mother's hoarding habit?
I was shocked. I was truly shocked, and I probably shouldn't have been given – you know, if I'd taken a closer look over the years. We live in the same city. She was living in the house that I had grown up in. You know, and I knew she had a lot of stuff. And I knew in recent years she had been having more and more trouble actually dealing with the stuff and kind of handling the tasks of daily life, including cleaning and so forth. She was never a minimalist. You know, she never had a, but I didn't grow up in squalor. And so it really went overnight. She had looking back, I can see that she had a lot of struggles with dementia and so forth that was setting in. Mentioned it was setting in before her crisis, but literally overnight, she was no longer able to live in her house. All of this stuff that had built up, she could make no decisions about it, and it all fell to me. And when I started actually going room by room and looking at everything, I could not believe how much stuff she had. And I thought, I knew it was bad. I did not know it was this bad. It was really a shock.
Yeah. So it sounds like in your situation, there was something of an exponential curve in her behaviors that lead to this kind of clutter. And that's different from some people who, without dementia, for year after year after year, live in these kinds of situations and become very adept at hiding it, I guess.
Yes, that is a big component of these a lot of these situations. Now, with my mother, I will say that she's had lifelong habits that I think set her up to be overwhelmed by her things when dementia set in. But people do get very, very adept at, you know, sometimes it gets to the point where people will not let even family members come in the house because they know that they're going to get criticized or that there's just too much stuff. But most of us have defensive strategies. You know, I think of it, well, before the pandemic, when we actually could go to each other's houses and visit, you know, people will say, oh, don't look at my desk. It's messy. I'll get to it. You know, some of it's just normal. Back and forth of life, but I think if it goes on too long and you can't kind of keep up with that daily life mess, then it can really sneak up on you and it becomes a years long problem.
Now, something happened to you where this personal situation of yours and confronting the legacy of your mother's life and the materials that you had to take care of. Something happened where that kind of launched you into quite an inquiry where you wanted to know the roots of this in society and in history. And I mean, not everybody has a mother who's a hoarder who then says, I'm going to go back to a century, two, three centuries back and try to tell the whole story. Where'd you get that impulse from? Was it really just about your mother's situation?
That was the genesis of it. Yeah, I mean, I'm trained as a journalist, and what journalists do when we don't understand something is we ask questions and we have conversations, right? We talk to people and find out what we don't know. It started with this great personal shock. And the first thing I did was to try to figure out what to do and how to proceed. And that, so I started talking to friends and neighbors and coworkers. And I started hearing, I thought my mother's situation was unique. It was so appalling and such a shock to me. But as I started talking to people, more and more stories like this came out. And a lot of people have to eventually clean out someone's house, you know, family member. That's certainly not uncommon, but a surprising number of people are confronted with something sort of like what I had to deal with. And I couldn't believe that this was not an anomaly. And that got me interested. I thought, why are so many of us struggling with this? Where does this come from? I thought it was just my mother's situation, but this is really a collective problem. And that got me interested one conversation led to another. So I started to see it as not just an individual problem, but this series of collective issues and problems and habits that have been several centuries.
Yeah. Well, I kind of want to now move away from your personal story and the story of your mother. I kind of want to pull Queen Victoria into the conversation. Would you be okay if we did that?
she won't sue me for libel.
That's right. Well, we're going to talk about that after a short break here on our show. We're visiting with Jennifer Howard. She is author of Clutter and Untidy History. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. We have with us journalist Jennifer Howard. She has been formerly a contributing editor for The Washington Post and a senior reporter for The Chronicle of Higher Education. She has a book that was released in 2020 titled Clutter and Untidy History. And so it wasn't maybe the Queen herself in England who had a problem with keeping things. But we talk about the Victorian era, and you spend a lot of time talking about everything from overstuffed furniture, too much furniture, and little tchotchkes and knickknacks and doodads that clutter up not only our lives, but this has been going on for a century plus.
It has. I really think we can blame the Victorians for a lot of our struggles with stuff. I mean, if you look at that era, it's so many trends and historical angles kind of collide in that era when you've got people living in cities, the rise of the bourgeois middle class, industry, the Industrial Revolution gearing up, so more things made more quickly and available to more people. You had this global trade of stuff with the British Empire and other, it wasn't just the British Empire, there really was a global trade that went beyond the British Empire, but textiles and all kinds of things kind of coming to Britain. You had the Crystal Palace and the Great Exhibition of 1853, and which was the Crystal Palace was basically an enormous display of stuff, every kind of thing, raw materials, the things you could make with the raw materials, furnishings. So it really, when I was trying to trace the origins of clutter, a lot of things pointed me back toward that period of time when we really got started to really get the appetite for things and also the industrial means to satisfy that craving and to fuel it.
You even spoke with somebody, I believe, who as a scholar goes to old sites where the Victorians dumped their stuff to kind of like an archaeologist dig through it and retrieve it and try to piece together a narrative about how people lived and what their values were.
You could learn a lot about somebody by what they throw out, right? What trash, what's in their trash can. And so this scholar, Tom Lysons, as a boy, got into hunting for Victorian glassware. So he'd go to local, and when I say garbage dumps, I'm not talking big landfills. I'm talking very small, like even a household, each household in some places would have a place to dump stuff. So he would go and dig for these bottles. And that got him as a, when he became a scholar, he, among other things, has continued that habit, but on a bigger scale. And talking to him about the kinds of things that Victorians would get rid of and the things he digs up. So yes, there's glassware, but there are also souvenirs, little, like you'd go down to Brighton or somewhere by the sea and you'd get a little vase or an egg cup or something and bring it back with you. It just fueled this hunger for stuff. And he could see the record of what they bought, what they threw out, and the increasing sense of disposability that starts to set in. It's fascinating. I hope someday if we get out of the pandemic to actually go on a dig with him, see what he finds.
Is it too simple for me to say that maybe the story of the Victorian era and the cluttering up of individual lives, it's a story of prosperity? And because oftentimes I just kind of think if you don't have the means to procure stuff, you're not gonna.
Yeah, no, I think it's important to bear that in mind, that in some ways it's a problem that afflicts affluent societies. Although, as we see here, you can have not very much money and still have way too much stuff, in part because of because of the way we can produce mass quantities of things and sell them very cheaply. So you can buy, it's too easy to buy too much stuff, even if you don't have that much money. But behind whatever the individual's income level is a system that is geared to, that depends on our wanting things and buying them and then buying more and more and more. So yes, it is kind of a late capitalist problem in many ways.
There are two prongs I want to pursue still here. And one is, do you feel like you in studying this have wrapped your head around the individual pathology of a single person and what drives a person to this kind of behavior? And the other is more societal in terms of the costs to all of us and where this is going to take us collectively as civilization.
Yes, there's still a lot of mysteries to me in individual behavior around this stuff. I mean, I definitely have a better sense of, I think, what brought my mother to the situation she found herself in that I then had to deal with. When I look back at her having a life that was maybe kind of deprived early on and maybe some overcompensating with stuff, and then growing up in the mid-century where you had all these catalogs and department stores and big box stores and all of that. So I have some appreciation now that a lot of circumstances can bring somebody, can make it hard for somebody to manage their things, whether it's actual hoarding disorder or, stress or dementia, bad luck. There's so many factors that can derail somebody when it comes to this stuff. But I do really, so I have more sympathy now than I used to for people who struggle with this. On the societal front, I do think that without going, you don't have to go full on Marie Kondo or minimalist or anything, but really thinking harder for all of us about what we need from our things, what we truly value, and how much time and money we want to spend managing them. I think that's just an important thing to do, both for ourselves and our families, but also for our planet, if that's not too corny. But when you think, you know, you get rid of something, it has to go somewhere. Is it going to go to a landfill? What did it take to make that thing? Did it get shipped from China or somewhere else? How much pollution was involved? Was there child labor involved? There are so many ethical and social problems and questions anyway that I think anybody, if they can, should be asking about things.
So this does push us in the direction of ethics and morality, doesn't it?
Very much. There's a lot of emotion tied up in things, and that's kind of the personal component. But, you know, these things do not exist in isolation. You know, they come from somewhere, they have to go somewhere, and they cost us, not just in money, but in time and energy. You know, all the time I spent cleaning out my mother's house, I would rather have been doing something else, honestly. And I didn't even have the pleasure of hearing her stories about any of the things. So there was a lot of loss. The objects themselves had kind of lost a lot of their function as memory keepers. And I think this is all, you know, all these questions end up pointing us toward choices about how we want to live now. And that's, you know, either how we want to live in our houses and how we want to live as a society, and what the costs truly are of having whatever it is.
What comes to your mind right off the bat as soon as I start talking about digital, data? This is kind of a new frontier for clutter, because there's a lot of clutter in the digital realm, and it can be overwhelming.
It can. I mean, for me, it's photographs. I have lots of other things on my computer and in the cloud, but, you know, thousands. I think my family photo archive is probably 30,000 photos, maybe more by this point, because we always have the iPhones, you know, click, click, click. And most of those are not photos that I need to preserve for posterity. I don't think posterity is going to want them, but they do sit there and, you know, take up space. And occasionally we want to find something, right? Some record of a moment. So this is one of the worst things about digital clutter is that it's generally not that visible. You know, it doesn't clutter up your living room. It doesn't get in the way of the Philadelphia Fire Department, you know, trying to get you out of your house. But it's there all the time. And when are we ever going to get around to dealing with it? That's the clutter. Someone said once to me that clutter is deferred decisions. And I think that could be the case with digital clutter as well. Because who has the time to sit down and, you know, go through the whole photo archive. And it's only going to be as life gets ever more digital, that will be an increasingly pressing issue, I think.
Yeah. I want to go back to this phrase, induced demand. I remember so well when I arrived at the university as a very young man, and I had to pick a major, and I was looking down the catalog of what was available for me at the university. And I remember right up at the letter A, advertising. I thought, advertising? You can get a degree in advertising? I was kind of naive. I had no idea. And to me, I kind of recoiled at that personally, because I thought, that's kind of where the tricksters go. You know, they're gonna hoodwink me into buying something I don't need, and there's actually probably something noble about doing advertising well, and yet, boy, have we gotten good at creating appetites that weren't there to begin with, and monetizing that in a way that kind of. It kind of is this machine that just cranks out stuff in a way. I don't even know what to do with that.
I think it's so interesting to me, this phenomenon, and it kind of seeps into many aspects of our lives almost without our realizing it. And it also has a long history. When I started looking at, we had the Victorians, but then you come to America and look at the system of, you know, the Sears catalog and Montgomery Ward catalogs that started off as real lifelines for people who did not live close to places where they could buy the things they needed. But then, you know, there's what you need, and then there's what you want. And the categories can be very slippery, especially in a system that wants you to think you need more than you do. And again, I'm not a minimalist. If you looked at my house, you would see some clutter. And things can bring us joy, and they can be lovely and make our lives more comfortable, safer, happier, whatever it is. But at some point, we're not really ever trained to think about when we have enough, or are we making the most out of what we already have? It's easy, and now it's so easy to go on Amazon, and especially in the pandemic, but even before, you know, it's the one-click shopping. It'll be on your doorstep tomorrow, maybe even tonight. You know, that's, then you get that little hit of serotonin, I guess, that you just, something fun has come to you. It's like Christmas every day. And that's neat, but it's also dangerous for both ourselves and our society, I think, if we go too far.
You tie in this one-click shopping problem of our consumerism. You tie that in to the ideas and the values of the minimalists, and almost as though minimalism and these kinds of concerns and kind of proactive fighting off the urge to – you kind of indicate that this is quasi-religious for some people. And I find that really fascinating. Explain why people would elevate minimalism to such a stature.
It is fascinating to me that there's a hunger for, I guess, to restore meaning to objects, and because we are so overwhelmed, so many of us, by them. But there is a sense that if you have an orderly life, you will have an orderly mind. You will be able to see your goals and achieve them more easily. And there are some spiritual overtones, like what's important to you, what really matters, what sparks joy. And Marie Kondo is not pushing religion per se, but there is a sense of trying to find some missing spiritual element in our material lives that I think the minimalists, some of them have really tapped into. It kind of reminds me of the Peloton phenomenon, where there's this sort of like a higher purpose. You know, if I can just, it's not just, oh, I need to straighten up some stuff and take it to Goodwill. I need to live in a more, you know, in an honest and ethical way, or this will be some sort of call. I can make this into almost a calling.
Yeah. Now, given the fact that you've already told us that you are not a minimalist, have you nonetheless had any success in trying, as you say, to restore meaning to an object? Have you had that experience?
I'm thinking harder about it, for sure. One thing I've gotten very interested in is the secondhand economy that has also existed for a long time. And the Victorians had peddlers. There were Yankee peddlers in this country. There's a guy in my neighborhood who's actually a scavenger, basically. He goes around and he finds bits of like metal piping, discarded appliances and things, and he'll break them down in the alley and then go and sell them to junk dealers. And it's fascinating to me. But I also, I'm trying to make more use of the Buy Nothing group in my neighborhood, which is a fairly widespread phonomenon now. It's kind of like Freecycle or Craigslist, much more local. So there's if you have an extra anything, I mean, the stuff that turns up is amazing to me.
So it's not even bartering,
patio,
is it?
Patio umbrella, flower. No, it's just given, it can be done almost in a spiritual way, though it doesn't have to be, but a sense of, oh, here I have too much stuff. There's abundance here, and I would like to share it with you. So I am trying to be more mindful. I don't just put things in the trash if I think I can find a home for them. Now, that does take time and energy, and that's something that is also a luxury. A lot of people have very busy, stressed lives and don't have necessarily time to go and find homes for all the stuff they can't use. But it is a nice, it has made me think more actively about making sure that we have enough for my family, but that it doesn't get to the point where my children are going to have to deal with the amount of stuff I had to deal with my mother.
And now we've come to the epilogue, basically, of in your book, where you once again return to the story, your personal story of dealing with your mother's effects. I'm just wondering if, having been through that and you've concluded that chapter and taken care of all of those things, Are you left with scars that just won't heal?
Boy, I'm left with a lot of regret on my mother's behalf, basically. And it was a very painful experience to go through. I won't deny that. It's something I hope never to repeat. I would rather have never gone through it in the first place. I think it did make me appreciate more that you know, people are not their things, and that things can be a meaningful part of our lives. So it helped me, you know, doing the research for the book and writing the book helped me take a very bad thing and turn it into something that helped me get through the trauma and see, you know, try to understand it as something part of it. It's part of a larger set of traumas and issues. And that ultimately, I think that can be hopeful. I don't know. I wish it had not happened in the first place, but it is unfortunately a very big part of a lot of people's lives.
You have on a shelf somewhere in your home, a little jar, a little glass container that has, I don't know, is it shells or beach sand or
pebbles? It's pebbles, yes.
Oh, pebbles from a beach. That's something you've had for years.
Yes, so my parents split up when I was very young, which is another issue with my mother. It was only me; there was no spouse or other children to deal with. But my dad and I would take trips in the summer, and we went to Crete, actually in Greece, which was a wonderful trip to take when I think was 11. And there was it's a Greek soda bottle, and it's filled with beach pebbles, and it's a completely, it has no material value whatsoever. But it conjures up, it's really a memory keeper. It's a souvenir in the deepest sense of the term, because I can look at that and think back to that trip, back to that good time with my father, a neat place, you know, really a special time. And I don't really need a lot of photos or anything else. I can just look at that bottle and have those memories come back. And it's nice. So that's, I like having certain objects that really can touch a deep part of life for me.
And that one works for you. It doesn't lose its luster. You turn to it and it's there to work.
It is. You know, and some of it, of course, is, and this is one reason why maybe it's not good to have clutter, because if you have too many things, each individual thing loses its meaning because you just can't see it anymore. And so it's, you know, I think a handful of objects that you have that are meaningful and that you, it's good to maybe to remind yourself to look at these things and appreciate them and not just use them as backdrops.
Jennifer Howard, I've enjoyed very much getting to know you and reading your book and the time we've spent here. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show, Marcus. It's been a lovely conversation, and thanks for exploring it in such nuance.
You're very welcome. We've had Jennifer Howard with us. She is author of Clutter, An Untidy History. Now, let's think about this just a little bit more. If you are going to hoard things, it probably does help to have access to really cheap stuff and a lot of it. Most of us just can't afford to fill our shelves and our lives with 24-karat gold knickknacks. So then you have to ask yourself, what is the allure of cheap, useless stuff, apart from any diagnosable pathology you may or may not have? Can cheap stuff actually be desirable? Does it have any redeeming characteristics? We're going to talk next with a history professor who has an answer when we return to Constant Wonder in just a moment. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. I suppose there are two main roads to getting clutter into your life. One is to be obscenely rich and fill your mansion with museum pieces of dubious taste, perhaps, but of great monetary value. And then the other road is that you can shop at what they used to call the five and dime store. I guess today we call it a dollar store, where you find great quantities of junk, a lot of it made in China. It's plastic often, not durable, doesn't have much deep purpose. We all have this kind of crap in our lives. Free t-shirts, snow globe collections, little knickknacks that we never quite managed to throw away. Is there any intrinsic allure to this cheap and useless stuff? Very important question that's been taken up by Wendy Woolison, who's a professor of history at Rutgers University, Camden. She's author of the book Crap, A History of Cheap Stuff in America. And I want to pull you into the conversation just where I was talking with her about a piece of junk that somehow entered my life. It's been in a kitchen drawer in times past in my home, a cooker that boils an egg into a cube, into a square sort of shape.
That particular gadget is not, but plenty of other gadgets and similar things do make it into the book, but it really epitomizes some of the things that I'm talking about. And you really hit on sort of the kind of curious and wonderfully innovative things about in particular gadgets, and yet at the same time, the problematic aspects of all of this crap, all of this stuff that we have in our lives.
Well, you've used the word gadget now, and I wonder, I tend to think in categories, and I think of a gadget as something as kind of like a little machine or it has a function to it. But just to be clear about the whole scope of what you're talking about, I want to play a little game with you if you're willing.
Sure.
Could you maybe – I'm going to give you – I'm looking at the clock here. If I gave you 60 seconds and you just were to do not totally free association but go through your mind the types of things, the little gadgets or things or crap that your book's about. Can I say ready, set, go and have you do that for us?
Sure.
Okay, here we go. 3, 2, 1, and go.
Okay. Multi-tools – medical contraptions, electrogalvanic belts for male enhancement, beanie babies, collectible commemorative plates, collectible coins, promotional materials like key fobs and...
That's 30 seconds. You've got 30 more seconds to go.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. I better step it up. Exploding novelty goods, exploding cigars, plastic vomit, things like that. Knickknacks and bric-a-brac of all sorts. Five and dime goods, little cocktail umbrellas, pocket coin purses, rain bonnets.
4, 3, 2, 1, and you're out of time. That was very good, actually. And as author of this book, I fully expected you to be able to list at least 5 to 6 things on the spur of the moment. Did you say plastic vomit in that list?
I did, yeah. I actually have a kind of an extended discourse in my book about the meaning of plastic vomit.
Yeah, this stuff, is any of it, is there any nobility? Is there any decorum? Is there any dignity in any of it?
You know, that's a really good question, and I guess I would say no. And I guess I would say no, and I think that's indicative of my title. You know, I could have called the book Stuff or Junk or Consumer Goods, but calling it crap is really a thesis of a sort, and I really don't think there's a lot of nobility in this. One of the things that I say, my definitions of crap is that it's deceitful and it's cynical. This is stuff that is poorly produced often. It's low priced. It's composed of inferior materials, not meant to last. Often it doesn't have meaning, or its meanings in the case of mass-produced collectibles are false meanings. In the case of gadgets, gadgets promise much more than they deliver. So they promise sort of wonderful, magical processes that don't often work or are impractical. So, I mean, I think that's a really, really good question, and a good way to put it is that these things, at least in my mind, are not particularly dignified. And that's not to say that they don't have meaning for us. I mean, my whole book kind of unpacks what these things do mean to us or have meant to us over time, and why we have become a nation of consumers of crappy things. But ultimately, you know, I don't see this as a very positive category of stuff by and large.
And if it's not positive, by the time the book's over, do you offer anything in the way of a corrective, or are you going to leave that to somebody else?
Well, I mean, there are other people who do that. You know, for example, people like Marie Kondo, who really preach a kind of minimalism. And there are other people out there who, you know, sort of the slow goods movement, who preach like buying artisanal things, handmade clothing, and all of that. And I do see a validity in that, but I do also see class aspects. Those are kind of lifestyles that only people with money and resources can really afford. So for most of us, the material world around us is a kind of necessarily degraded, cheapened material world, because that's all we can afford. and it's all that's really available to us on the market. And that's really what brought me to this project was, you know, there have been plenty of studies on, understandably so, on, you know, like fine antiques and masterpieces and things that are really nicely made. And we've paid a lot of attention to that. But for most of us, that's not the stuff that fills our houses. That's not what we spend our money on. And so I really wanted to unpack, you know, this other sort of category of goods and what they mean to us now and sort of how we came to this state. So I do sort of a long history of craft in America.
Yeah, I do want to get into the backstory of how this all happened in the first place, and I'm sure we'll get there in a moment or two. But just I want to stick with definitions for a bit because they're so fun. Mm-hmm. And in your introductory material, at some point you say that crap is, quote, not a particular type of object, but an existential state of being, a right. quality of a thing rather than the thing itself. Could you elaborate on that? That's so interesting.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, so what's, to be clear, like what's crappy to me might not be crappy to you. So you, I'll give you an example. I've got like a little tape measure from the Patent and Trademark Office. And it's something I would put in the category of swag, free crap, you know, the stuff that giveaways that we have just around our house all the time. And so for somebody else, this might be a crappy thing that you get and then you cast aside. For me, I use that little tape measure all the time. So it's not really like that I can say that that tape measure is a crappy thing, but it depends on its context and it depends on really kind of my expectations for this thing and whether that thing has delivered on those expectations. I think gadgets, we've mentioned this a couple of times already, but gadgets is a really good example of that, where even as far back as the 19th century, but even today, if you watch, like I love watching the infomercials about, you know, the latest air fryers or yeah. the garden tools and all these things that promise to do all of this great stuff, making your work easier, making it enjoyable, doing these extraordinary things, they're very performative. And so we buy them with this anticipation that we too will be able to work our magic with these devices. And invariably, they fall short. They don't do what they're supposed to do, or they cause us more work in the end because they're hard to clean, or they, you know, fall apart, or they're so specific in their function that they're really kind of useless in the end.
Well, I want to point to a specific time in history, an era, and maybe this will open the door for you to talk about where this all began. And I think I'm starting a little late in the game, but in a way, these products, these cheap things, they have to kind of be oversold to us in this culture of American consumer convenience, because I'm thinking of maybe in the 40s and 50s, those old print ads, a housewife with one hand on a Hoover vacuum and it just glides through the room on its own practically, you know, and with a big smile on her face. Is that overselling of ease and convenience, is that part of this package, of this history?
It is. It is. And you actually raise an interesting point, which is, and it's something I touch upon in my book. It's there's a fine line between a useless gadget and a real innovation. And so these vacuum cleaners might have been real innovations that were game changers in the way that women did their housework. But if we go back in time to say the 1890s, when women were doing laundry by hand, this is the time when newfangled was the term. Newfangled laundry machines, washers, were introduced to the market. And as you say, oversold, overpromised to do all of these things. And they actually didn't make women's lives any easier. In fact, they created more work and they were rusty and they, you know, they sort of retained these foul odors and they were not helpful things at the time, but most of us now cannot imagine living without a washing machine. Another example is the answering machine, which Hemmerker Schlemmer introduced in the, I can't remember if it was the 1950s or 1960s. And at the time, it was this like luxury device for people with too much money, you know, on their hands. So they're going to get this answering machine that really was just this luxurious kind of extravagantly useless thing. And now, of course, we can't live without voicemail. So some of these things were truly innovative eventually, but things like your egg cooker, I'm not sure if there will ever be sort of a golden age for square-shaped egg cookers. You know, I don't know. But I should just say that even gadgets that aren't useless are often wonderfully creative.
No, I have to think about that now. Even gadgets that are useless could be wonderfully. I mean, there can be some real creativity there for something that nobody needs.
Yeah, it takes a visionary to create such things or combination gadgets. You know, putting two odd functions together. In the 19th century, we see this a lot with combination of a writing pen and a fishing pole. You know, these really odd mashups of items and functions that are really improbable. But to me, it's also, and this is the kind of the more positive aspect of the crap that you alluded to in your introduction, is that some of these things really are opportunities for people to be very creative. Perhaps uselessly so or extravagantly so, but nonetheless, there is some invention and innovation with a lot of these things.
Wendy Wollison is a professor of history at Rutgers University, Camden. She's author of Crap, A History of Cheap Stuff in America. On to something new. One of the looming legends from America's military history, General George Patton, a complicated figure to say the very least. He was bombastic, seemingly unhinged at times. He carried pearl-handled revolvers as sidearms. He was known to abuse soldiers that he thought were shirking their duty. But he also had the foresight and the moxie, maybe just the pure bullheadedness, that was needed at some pivotal moments in World War II, in Europe in particular. Patton, a legend in his own time and also in his own mind. And we're going to get into that aspect, trying to size up his character, when we return to Constant Wonder after the news. Stay with us.